from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Over 10 years ago, former Vice President Al Gore gave a slideshow presentation that would change his life and transform the conversation on climate change. The slideshow became a documentary called An Inconvenient Truth. It won two Oscars and became a call to arms. Now, Al Gore is out with a new book and film called An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power.
The next generation would be justified in looking back at us and asking, what were you thinking? Couldn't you hear what the scientists were saying? Couldn't you hear what Mother Nature was screaming at you?
We'll talk to the filmmakers, and near the end of the hour, we'll be joined by Al Gore. That's all coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Call it the slideshow scene around the world. In 2006, working with National Geographic, former Vice President Al Gore put together a traveling slideshow about the perils of climate change, and the presentation formed the basis for An Inconvenient Truth, a documentary that went on to win two Oscars, helped catapult Al Gore to a Nobel Prize, and became a ringing call to arms to curb the effects of climate change. Now, over 10 years later, many predictions about climate change have come true, from melting ice shelves to rising sea levels. So Al Gore is coming out with a new book and documentary tackling the next chapter of global warming and the climate change movement. It's called An Inconvenient Sequel, and we're going to talk to the two filmmakers in this hour. We're joined by later in this hour, we'll be joined by Al Gore himself. But joining us now in studio are Bonnie Cohen, co-director of An Inconvenient Sequel. Welcome.
Thank you.
And John Schenck, also co-director and cinematographer of An Inconvenient Sequel. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you both here with us on Forum. And this is another call to arms, but it's 10 years later. So the message is pretty much still the same, but maybe in some ways even more call to arms.
Well, weather events, climate-related weather, extreme weather has gotten worse. And that was one of the main reasons Al Gore got together again with participant media to make a sequel. They thought long and hard about what was the reason for coming back and doing this 10 years later. The extreme weather has gotten worse. It's true. We've had 10 hottest years on record in the last 14 years, and it's not what we had expected, not what we wanted to see after An Inconvenient Truth came out in 2006. But on the other hand, there are solutions in place now that make it possible for us to do some turning around and get a handle on this. So, you know, there's a sustainability revolution underway, and alternative energy is cost efficient now, and we can get it in place around the world. It's just a question of how quickly we're going to do it.
And it all comes in under the purview of the film. And you've also got a lot of local and state and other countries who are still aboard on the Paris Agreement, who are working assiduously to do an immense amount about climate change. But this film really got underway before Donald Trump was elected president. And now you have an administration that's pretty antipathetic to the idea of climate change, or so it would seem.
Yeah, we started this film in July 15, about 6 months before the negotiations took place that resulted in really an amazing first ever international deal in Paris, December 2015, where all the countries of the world got together and signed an accord that put a kind of a protocol in place that would move the world to the right track to solving the problem. After decades of negotiations at the UN level, it was really a remarkable moment in environmental history.
And a remarkable moment that the United States no longer subscribes to, and things have shifted, not only in terms of global warming getting worse in many ways, but shifted in the respect of China having leadership. Who would have thought it, huh? But, you know, you use global warming a lot in the film still, and there are many people who say, call it climate change, don't call it global warming. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, global warming is one symptom of what Al Gore refers to as the climate crisis. I think it used to be in the early days of studying this phenomenon that we would study air temperature, maybe ocean temperature. But really what's happened is we have mankind, in burning fossil fuels mostly for electricity and for transportation, has altered this very complex system in which we live, planet Earth. And what scientists have realized in the last few years, since the first Inconvenient Truth, is that when you change several crucial factors to such a complex system, then everything in that system changes along with it. So in the film, you see this remarkable footage, not only of glaciers exploding in Greenland, where we went, on some of the hottest days in 2015, but you see that all storms are different now. You see rain bombs occurring because the moisture builds up in the atmosphere in incredible ways. You see droughts occurring that, you know, once in a thousand year droughts, once in a thousand year floods happening year after year, to the point where history isn't a marker anymore of what we see in our weather patterns.
Yeah, the melting Greenland glaciers are really profoundly compelling. I mean, just to see that on the screen. And then Bonnie, to make the link, of course, there's a little levity about a Swiss cheese joke with a Swiss scientist who's right. with Al Gore taking him around everything. But the sight that we're seeing is really extraordinary. And then suddenly you're in Miami Beach with all that water, and there's a link because of the sea level rise.
Yeah, we found that link to be potentially the most important link in the film, because often in climate crisis films, documentaries, it's very easy to kind of keep the crisis at arm's length as a viewer. You don't necessarily... you're not necessarily compelled visually to draw it into your own life. So when we were standing on the edge of those glaciers with Al Gore, a guy who's been, you know, thinking about this crisis for 40 years and working on its behalf.
And as you show in the film, going all around the world.
Right? Going all around the world, yeah, taking in new information from scientists, meeting with climate refugees, talking with politicians, business leaders, you know, doing everything he can do. And then to see him standing on the edge of that glacier with this kind of, you know, when we get up high, we have some incredible drone footage where you get up high on the glacier and you can see the cracks in the ice that almost look like a virus has taken over the ice there. To go from that emotional moment down to Miami Beach, where literally there are fish swimming on a sunny day on the streets of, you know, so the flooding on the streets are not because of rain. It's because the ocean water has come up onto the streets of Miami Beach, Florida. We felt that that was, from a film's perspective, an incredible connection to make for viewers who want to look away.
And you also, in the film, John, bring to viewers for just all that's going on in an energy revolution. And a lot, indeed, of course, has gone on since the first film was made with renewables and with anti-fossil fuels. The film's been labeled as anti-coal, though, let's talk about that, because there are those who see that as propaganda and who come out with an indictment against it. And there are those who say, you know, that Hillary Clinton was hurt by sounding as if she was anti-coal in West Virginia and other states where coal is important.
Well, you know, there's no question that our country needs to figure out a way to retrain and bring jobs to the people who did coal mining and worked in the fossil fuel industry in our country. They've helped build our country.
And that was always Gore's argument back when he was with Clinton.
Yeah, I think
still says so.
Anybody who wants to build a future based on innovation and real kind of future-looking job market in this country knows that that's the case, that we need to go to those communities first, because it was really on their backs with, you know, that we built our great civilization that we live in this country. And then when you see, you know, largely through Al Gore's eyes, because that's the film is about him, what is going on with the sustainability revolution in terms of alternative energy, it really is amazing. As dramatic as the global warming trends have been in recent years, the cost down curve graphs of the price of solar energy and wind is breathtaking. We're paying pennies on the dollar of what we used to pay for solar, to the point now where it's really become a policy choice rather than a financial choice. It's really actually as cheap, if not cheaper, to get energy from solar in many communities around this country. And you see in the film, Republican mayors in Texas are choosing to go 100% renewable because it actually makes financial sense.
You also take us to Solar City right here in Silicon Valley in our own backyard in the film. And Bonnie, also in the film, It's a very personal film in some ways, not only about Al Gore and his mission and really his commitment that has continued all these 10 years. We're going to talk with former Vice President Gore toward the end of this hour. And, of course, we'll give you an opportunity to weigh in, too, on the content in the film which we're discussing. But I was struck, for example, by you're taking us to Carthage, Tennessee, and, you know, in his home and pictures on the wall and memorabilia and Al Gore kind of reflecting in a very personal way, but also reflecting about his own fluctuation and vacillation between hope and despair. And it's been quite a journey for him.
Well, yeah, that's right. We try in this film to paint a portrait of a man who is leaving, who is in the middle of leaving a legacy to this country, both as a public servant, first as a politician, and now he's serving as an activist. He's an environmental activist, for lack of a better term for him. But in terms of his personal trajectory and his professional trajectory, it's very poignant to think about the fact that he thought he was on a very particular path as a politician, is following in his father's footsteps. They're a political family. They're a huge Democratic family.
Yeah, there's a picture, in fact, I just have to insert this, of his father on Meet the Press and then Al on Meet the
That's
Press.
That's right. Yeah, and it's poignant to see it and to be there on the farm, his parents' farm where he grew up and where, you know, the torch was really passed to him. Then he had and he was a public servant for many, many years. His political life really ending in 2000 with the one vote in the Supreme Court that voted against him taking office as president. And he makes this other career for himself. He sort of it almost seems impossible to come back from the ashes of that and go on to become somebody at the top of their field doing this incredible work, potentially even work that he might not have been able to do or accomplish if he had been president. So the climate crisis, not to be too corny about it, but there's a sense when you look at the climate crisis that, you know, how are we ever going to get out from underneath this and move forward? And now we're starting to see that we can get ourselves out of the ashes of this, and we have to move and do it as a community. So we draw some parallels between Al Gore's personal and professional life that hopefully.
Yeah, I just read an interview where he was talking about, we may talk about this with him, when we talked to him at the end of the hour, he said, I'm just kind of a hillbilly here in the Ozarks, you know, I like to go and take it easy and all the rest of that sort of thing. But also, when he lost the election, his concession speech was really quite moving, and that's in the film as well. But John, I was struck by how when Cheney and Bush and Cheney took over, you go to great lengths in the film to spotlight the Discover. I mean, the Discover
satellite.
Excuse me. And just how that had to be scrapped, and again, coming out of the ashes here, maybe suggests that Discover could indeed come back. Talk about Discover in its role.
Yeah, in the film, you see this little known history of NASA, which in the 90s, NASA worked to build this incredible satellite that eventually became known as the Discover satellite, which had put some very sophisticated climate measurement instruments in orbit around the Earth. And Al Gore, of course, was vice president at the time. He was actually overseeing the NASA effort for the White House at the time, and he was very interested in somebody who cared about the environment to get these tools up in space so that scientists could take advantage of them. And one thing led to another. It became a political football in the 90s, and after Bush and Cheney took office, the satellite was scrapped. It was put in storage. Fast forward many years later, when Obama was elected, Gore was able to go to Obama and explain to him the importance of these instruments that would help us measure for the first time ever the energy balance of the planet, and therefore just know a whole lot more about how we're affecting the ecosystem.
Which is truly the measure of the climate crisis, right? Energy in versus energy out.
Yeah, and that's just one of the many things that it measures. And in the film, you see it finally launch, which is a kind of a metaphor for the importance of who we have in office and how much they care about the planet.
Well, Al Gore also went, as many people know, to Trump Tower and talked to the president, who was not yet elected, I believe, or just elected, and tried to stress to him and emphasize the importance of climate change and apparently, from all accounts and all that's followed, it's somewhat fallen on deaf ears. We don't know. I mean, there's been a little vacillating from President Trump. When he was campaigning, he was talking about climate change as if it didn't exist. You know, there's that footage you guys have of him standing out, oh, global warming, look how cold it is here. You know, we need some global warming. But the reality is that we've kind of been moving backward. I mean, not only Paris, but in so many ways, the EPA, et cetera. And yet Al Gore pushes on and believes that there is a great deal of hope and that the planet can be saved.
Well, there's good reason for it. There's plenty that's being done. I mean, yes, of course, it's we've got someone in office now as president of this country who doesn't take global warming, doesn't take the climate crisis seriously. It's evident in his desire
I'm sorry to say he doesn't take a lot of science seriously.
Right. Well, he's attempting to dismantle the EPA. His appointments alone suggest a lack of respect for the crisis and ways of combating it. And he's, you know, he's obviously the most recent thing pulling out of.
Well, it's not only him. Greg Pruitt now has said, you know, we got to have a debate. You know, we got to have a pro and con on climate change.
I mean,
the debate is still ongoing.
It's absurdist. But on the other hand, there are so many good signs that are happening in this country on the local and state level. You know, as we talk about in the film, if President Trump isn't going to lead on this, the American people will. And that's happening in cities all around this country. You know, Atlanta just declared they were going to go carbon neutral. Pittsburgh, California is great on this. Massachusetts. Like
Pittsburgh, when the president talked about Pittsburgh and Paris, right? You remember?
Yeah. I think one of the incredible things that happened that really it was almost impossible to foresee is that the day after Trump's speech, you know, regarding the withdrawal of the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord.
Bad deal.
Yeah.
I like your Trump impersonation, by the way. there was this incredible backlash, which nobody can anticipate, which is that, you know, Trump said that he was elected to be president of the people from
Pittsburgh,
not Paris, presumably because of the letter P. And
that was the common denominator.
The next day, the mayor of Pittsburgh stood up and said, hey, wait a minute. I'm the mayor of the people of Pittsburgh, and we want to stay in the Paris Agreement because we know that's good for our city. We know that's good for our planet. And as Bonnie said, other mayors have done the same. Our governor in California is doing incredible work, and other governors around the country.
And a lot of Republican mayors are flipping on this issue.
And worldwide, leaders are doubling down on Paris. That's the thing that's really amazing is that it seems to have been galvanized the energy around Paris rather than take away from it. There's a lot of fear that if Trump pulled the U.S. out, that other countries would use that as cover to pull out. But there's just so much clarity now around this issue in this country and around the world that people are scared and they're very motivated to – partly because of the finances and the industry possibilities with sustainable energy. They're very motivated to be the places on the planet that actually create those new factories of tomorrow, building the solar panels and building the wind turbines that are going to power our cities.
It's an economic reality.
We're talking to filmmakers Bonnie Cohen and John Schenck, co-directors of An Inconvenient Sequel. And An Inconvenient Sequel, subtitled Truth to Power, is in theaters July 28th. Former Vice President Al Gore will be appearing at the Castro Theater tonight for a screening, which is sold out. But we are open and available for your comments. And the discussion is going, of course, once again into global warming. Some of you, of course, remember the first film, which actually I was had the privilege of introducing former Vice President Al Gore when it screened here in Convenient Truth for the first time. And you may want to weigh in on the film. You know, there's still this argument, why do so many people need to be convinced? And then there's the argument from the other side that this is a film like this is propagandistic and so forth. But really, we're talking about global warming. We're talking about climate change. And we do indeed want to hear from you. And let me tell you how you can join the program. We invite your calls. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join us at that toll-free number. Again, it's 866-733-6786. There are a number of other ways you can have your voice heard and speak to, well, truth to power is what they're talking about here, but also talk about global warming with us and join our conversation. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or you can go to our Facebook page. Many ways you can have your voice heard and become a part of this conversation. And let's hear a clip from An Inconvenient Sequel. And this clip from the trailer for the documentary former Vice President Gore alludes to some of the backlash to the original film.
The most criticized scene in the movie An Inconvenient Truth was showing that the combination of sea level rise and storm surge would flood the 9/11 memorial site. And people said, what a terrible exaggeration.
Hurricane Sandy slammed into New York City last night, flooding the World Trade Center site.
Storms get stronger and more destructive. Watch the water splash off the city. This is global warming.
There it is. and the footage is convincing. The voice is authoritative and convincing and so forth. You still have a lot of people to convince about this. That's the real nub of it, isn't it?
Well, that's true. What we try and do in the film and is to start to connect the dots between what we are calling global warming, what is global warming, part of the climate crisis, and real events, real tragedy that's happening around the world, whether that be the Zika virus coming further up into the northern hemisphere because temperatures are warming, whether that's more of an influx of refugees into Europe and other places around the world due to food shortages, drought that lead to civil war, et cetera. We try and make real world connections in the film. Al does. He's very he's actually consumed with this because he believes that the local news, the national news, does not always connect those dots, and we need to start doing that as a population in order to really get a handle on what it means, this crisis that we're in.
Well, a lot has happened since 2006 when An Inconvenient Truth first came out, and I'll also ask you, our listeners, are you more or less hopeful about mitigating climate change now? And let's hear one more clip. This the film, as was indicated by the filmmakers who were here with us in studio, had to be re-edited to include some new material on the United States pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Let's listen. This is, again, from the trailer.
It's crunch time at the climate change conference in Paris.
Still some really tough negotiations going on.
What would it take to shift to renewables?
I'm talking about breaking the impasse. Virtually every nation in the entire world agreed to get to zero greenhouse emissions. It is unprecedented.
It's time to put America first. That includes a promise to cancel billions in climate change spending.
Our plan will end the EPA.
Again, we're talking to filmmakers Bonnie Cohen and John Schenck about An Inconvenient Truth that came out in 2006, but also the sequel, which they co-directed, and a lot has happened since then. An Inconvenient Sequel, Truth to Power, is in theaters beginning July 28th. And as I said, we're going to bring you into the conversation and bring your thoughts, and they are welcome. We'll go to your calls when we return. Again, our toll-free number, let me just give it out one more time, is 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Bonnie Cohen, John Schenck with us, and you will be with us after the break, and so will former Vice President Al Gore. We'll be talking to him as we come toward the end of the hour. Stay tuned. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking to filmmakers Bonnie Cohen and John Schenck about An Inconvenient Sequel, which is subtitled Truth to Power. It's in theaters beginning July 28th, and Vice President Gore is in town. He'll be joining us toward the end of the hour. He's going to be appearing at the Castro tonight. Unfortunately, that screening is sold out. What do you both, I'll ask perhaps the same question of Vice President Gore when he joins us, but what do you hope will be the ultimate effect of a film like this? I mean, I was talking over the weekend at the Castro about refugees, about a film that has to do with refugees, and we get into this whole discussion about what's the effect of a film in terms of changing and making even, should we get, sea changes, quantum changes?
Absolutely.
Well, first one did.
The first film, by almost any measure, was one of the most successful documentaries of all time. We really stand on the shoulders of Davis Guggenheim, the director of that film. It obviously did gangbusters in the box office. But more importantly, it really gave us the language with which to discuss this topic. A lot of people really were hearing about it for the first time in such a clear way when Al Gore delivered that message. This film stands on the shoulders and goes into Al's life in a way it's closer to Al. I think people will feel like they get to know him better. They'll also understand that what's changed in the last 10 years is it's become more of an emotional issue for people. I think it's closer to what you would call a social movement now. Al and others are aligning the movement to save our planet with the civil rights movement, with the movement to, you know, have suffrage for women in the early part of the last century. And it's not a crazy metaphor when you think about the fact that so many people, especially poor people around the world, will suffer if we keep going down the same path, burning fossil fuels. And so people are starting to think about the legacy. What kind of planet will our children inherit, our grandchildren? And then even Republicans who have kind of been talking the talking points from the fossil fuel industry for decades are starting to think, do I want that to be my legacy?
You know, it's interesting. You cover the training programs that Al Gore instituted for people to go out there and really spread the word on global warming and so forth. And it did remind me of the civil rights movement, you know, because they would have people in a group and they would have a leader that was essentially galvanizing them and getting them organized. So also in your film, Bonnie, let me go to you on this. There's the blue marble and the whole sense of people being inspired to do this kind of work just by seeing some of these shots that we have now of the planet Earth.
Well, the blue marble, as you mentioned, galvanized the whole modern environmental movement. People saw that image. It was the first time that we could see Earth from space in that way with that kind of clarity. And people stood up and took notice. It did. It's exactly what it did. And interestingly, just to carry on what John was saying in terms of the first film and kind of getting people moved to act, as we moved around the world with Al Gore and we went to these training programs and the Paris Climate Conference and scientists in Greenland and wherever we went, we would meet people who had seen the first film at maybe the age of 15 or 16 and now were, you know, in their adult lives, and they had made the decision to do work in the climate space. And so we'd meet them he'd run into them in the halls of Paris or, you know, even
on the
streets.
How about in Beijing, in India, too?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There were people there doing work at NGOs, even at the ministerial levels in countries around the world who had been so moved by the information that they got in that film that they either changed their careers or started their careers in the climate space.
The woman running the climate conference at Paris for the UN, Christiana Figueres, saw the film in 2006, signed up for one of Al's trainings, went to Nashville.
She was at the second one ever, I think, the second training ever.
Yeah, and now she was the person in charge of organizing the deal-making in Paris that led to the first-ever international comprehensive agreement on climate change. So to say that the film had an effect, absolutely. The difference now is that you can do more than change your light bulbs. Whether you're in school, you know, you live in a home, you live in a community, you want to get involved in local or state or national politics, you can really start to ask, what can I do with my voice? What can I do with my vote? And what can I do with my choices in life to bring about this, you know, move towards alternative energy faster?
I mean, you mentioned Paris again, and I was joking before about bad deal. But there are some who really agree with that. They think because it didn't have teeth, it wasn't necessarily a good deal. And the United States had to put up too much money and had to not only put in too much money, but had to, particularly for nations who were developing nations, put out a lot of our resources.
Well, if you ask the scientists and the policymakers and who are doing the climate work, yes, the parameters of Paris are not enough, but it actually created for the first time a way. And actually the French leadership, the French government really deserve a lot of credit for getting it done. For the first time, instead of having every country agree to the same set of carbon limitations, they pledged to do what they felt that their country could do in the amount of time by the end of the century.
It's a pledge. Like I said, no teeth in it.
It's a pledge, but there are... You know,
but there's an important mechanism in the agreement that after 5 years, there's this mechanism called review and ratchet. So the idea was that
you can take it up a notch.
The first go at it might not be enough, but at least everybody is included in the fight. And then after 5 years, Every country would review their own policy and then hopefully ratchet their carbon restrictions. And this idea has actually been proven successful because India, not even a year after Paris was agreed, India stepped up and said, look, we didn't think it was possible, but now with financing from the World Bank and other sources of financing and intellectual property that we have that can move towards building solar panels in our country, we are going to cancel all future coal plants.
Let me bring a caller in here. Mike, you're first up. Welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah. You've probably heard that Germany, where it's not too sunny for the last two summers, broke 50% of their energy from solar. And that for the last 38 years, the percent of energy the world gets from solar has been doubling, kind of like Moore's Law, and it's now at 2%. And that means we're just about six doublings or 12 years away from 100% of the world's energy essentially available from solar. But then, of course, 2 years later, then it would be 200, then it would be 400. And that's just the trend in solar, let alone trends in wind and biofuels and geothermal and other sources of energy. And so given the trends in renewables, how much does this affect the picture as we sort of ride this exponential energy curve?
Well, there's no question that Al Gore actually refers to the sustainable energy revolution as something that will affect the economy on the scale of the industrial revolution, but will happen with the speed and efficiency of the digital revolution. And that is really gets into a whole other realm of kind of questioning our federal government's policy of why aren't we on the forefront of trying to get the planet on the right track for the environmental purposes, but for economic purposes to be the country where this innovation is happening, to build the companies, to build the factories that are doing exactly what you are talking about. California has decided, yes, we want to be part of that. Jerry Brown and our state government has decided, I think this summer there was a few days where we reached well over 60% power from renewable sources in the state of California.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go right on to another caller. Daniel, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I was curious about this notion of a debate between the climate side. I've always thought of it as akin to arguing the Holocaust with a Holocaust denier. But I've talked to a lot of intelligent people that say, well, if it's so obvious, why are you so afraid of having a discussion? I'd be curious about the filmmaker's take on that.
Thank you for your question. We get it a lot. And, as Al Gore says in the film, and I think this is something to say to climate deniers, there's a new voice in this debate that's very loud, and it's Mother Nature. There are ways in which weather patterns are changing and not only affecting, people in the Philippines and India and Sri Lanka, but farmers in the middle of this country, fishermen who are making their livings up in Alaska and dealing with the warming waters and patterns of weather that they don't recognize. There's going to start to be a way in which the deniability is impossible because those voices are starting to get very loud and affecting our economy. And affecting our ways of life. So I think Mother Nature's voice in this conversation is probably worth noting when speaking with people who you can't convince.
Let me thank the caller and again remind you that we are talking with the filmmakers of An Inconvenient Sequel, Bonnie Cohen, co-director, and John Schenck, co-director. And our next caller is Jonathan. Jonathan, welcome. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my phone call. I was wondering if your guests know anything about how the political parties separated in their beliefs of climate change and climate science. It seemed to me, maybe I'm misremembering this, but it seemed to me sometime in the past they were more together on the whole subject of climate change and climate science, and then somewhere along the line they split. And one side is a strong supporter of the phenomenon, and they seem to understand the science, and the other side just seems to be completely blind to it.
It's an important question you're raising, and thank you for it, Jonathan. There's a moment in the film, in fact, which I was quite sensitive to when Al Gore was giving testimony, and he was Al Gore, a private citizen at that time, not Vice President Gore, and in a way was, you know, kind of looking away or whatever of Oklahoma. And Barbara Boxer, former senator of California, said, please give him the courtesy of hearing what he has to say. Those kind of divisions seem to have sprung up like
How did the future of our natural world become a partisan issue?
Well, it's really there's been whole books and films made about this subject, but you know, as always, you have to follow the money. You know, back in the 80s when the ozone hole appeared in our atmosphere and there was a kind of a crisis, an environmental crisis, actually it was only a matter of a couple years before at the UN level the problem was solved. And it was generally universally thought of that Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals agreed that we should save our planet from having a hole in our ozone layer. And we got rid of those chemicals that created that. When information about global warming and the climate crisis first started to appear and really get into the mainstream, the fossil fuel companies really took a play out of the tobacco company's playbook, which is they literally hired the same PR companies to cast doubt on the science that
you're right. They were literally the same companies in many instances.
Yeah, and they worked on that
and they were hiring people to tell this tale.
And they worked on that all through the 80s and 90s. And then despite that, the issue was getting a bit of a footing in the 90s. One thing that happened that was significant is in 2008, with the birth of the Tea Party, the fossil fuel interests, the Koch brothers and the like, really doubled, tripled, quadrupled down on their effort, and they started funding the kind of radical right. And part of that funding came with strings attached, which is they had talking points about fossil fuels and casting more doubt. And that really, in an exaggerated way, really split the parties. And that's been going on since about 2008 or so, that things have gotten really ugly. And it became kind of this tribal thing between conservatives and liberals, where liberals believe the science and conservatives, kind of part of their tribal association, is that they deny the science.
So there's
there's
a waking up going on. I was just thinking about there's a guy that we met that Al Gore really had an influence on. He used to run the Cato Institute, which is probably the most conservative think tank in the country. And he was in charge of energy, which was the department at Cato Institute that gave out all the information on climate and climate denial. And he was influenced to completely turn around on it, having heard Al Gore talk and think more about it from an economic perspective. And now he's got his own organization where he kind of appeals to Republicans and economists to take the climate crisis seriously. So, you know, there are those that are stepping out from the rhetoric, and it's happening more and more. We're seeing it happen around the country in Southern California.
Yeah, Daryl Issa, representative from the state of California, southern part of the state, recently flipped his position on climate science because
was that before or after he snuck into the White House?
Not sure, but he noticed something that I think a lot of conservatives are noticing, which is that they're not in line with their constituency anymore. Every one of the 50 states has a majority now that believes in man-made climate science and has a majority of belief that something should be done about it.
Well, I'm going to read some comments that are coming in here. Jake writes, when are we going to realize that it is politicians that are causing climate change? Industry and people are always working to limit their waste of resources because it's in their economic best interest. Well, John mentioned the Koch brothers and others who feel differently than that, but I appreciate the comment from Jake. And here's a comment from Lee who says, you got the wrong end of the issue. Please focus some of your efforts on restoring our electoral processes so that the majority who strongly agree with you can actually rule. And Mike writes, I saw An Inconvenient Truth and thought it was great. I'm wondering how you convince major corporations and people who think there is no climate change that climate change is real. Of course, many corporations are lining up. I mean, and you know, that's the good news.
Yeah, that's
as you
true.
Were alluding before.
Absolutely.
But what do you do when people's minds are made up? I mean, about anything, you know, how do you sort of unmoor them to whatever they have decided is the fact?
Well, in the film, you see Al training hundreds, if not thousands, of activists at a time to do something that he thinks is really important, which is to win the conversation, know the facts, and when this comes up, don't let it don't let it just fly. Let you know, challenge people who are
and challenge your legislators. In particular.
Absolutely. And the
California, I think, has very few legislators here in Northern California, at least, who need to be challenged.
We're doing a good job up here.
But stepping away from, say, your own cocoon is an important part of what you're advocating.
Yeah, you asked earlier what we hope for the film. And, you know, we have the great fortune with this film to be releasing with Paramount Pictures. And it's not often that a documentary has a major studio behind it. So we actually are seeing on August 4th, this film is going on to 500 screens around the country, which, you know, and some of those screens are not, hopefully we're not going to be preaching to the choir. And so it's our hope that we can get people into theaters who don't necessarily already feel exactly the way we do about the climate crisis and can learn something, but also...
You can get global distribution as well, like with Inconvenient Truth?
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. They'll be going out in the fall.
Paramount will be going out
internationally in the fall. But also school groups, like a lot of what happened with the first film and the reason so many young people were moved and motivated was because they were able to see the film through school groups that were taken into the theater. This happened with other films like The Bully Project, Selma, when it was out. They had an amazing educational outreach program of simply getting students into seats in theaters. And we're hoping that that happens here as well, because, you know, kids can have a huge amount of influence.
Well, there's a dovetail question here from Mary, who says, I live in the Bay Area. It would be great if the guests would give specific activities that the layperson can get involved in. It feels a bit overwhelming to me. Well, You're talking about going to legislators, but there are these training programs that are out there now that former Vice President Gore got started. Yeah,
yeah, you can certainly look on Climate Reality's website to see if you're interested in actually going to one of Al Gore's trainings. There are 2-3 day events where you learn the nuts and bolts of how to deliver information, and you learn the latest climate science. You also learn what's going on with the latest in the sustainable energy. But, you know, people often say that to us. But going back to what we were talking about earlier is because of the viability of solar and wind now in your own home, in your school, if you're a student, you can ask your if you work for a company, what their policies are and where their energy comes from. There are things that you can do just simply by asking questions. You can, in many cases in California now, you can call companies to come to your house, have solar panels put on your house, and tomorrow you can be paying a cheaper bill for your power.
Also, what's going to be available on the Inconvenient Sequel website is a 10-minute version of Al Gore's slideshow, which you can download and actually have at your fingertips a lot of the facts of the climate crisis and the alternative energy revolution to share with people if you feel that you have an ability to win the conversation with one person a day, one person a week, who may not feel the way you do about this. That's also another opportunity.
Here's a note from Gary, a listener who says, without an all-out effort to curb population growth, any movement towards saving the planet is pointless. Respond to that kind of pessimism.
Well, there is a bit of a feedback loop with sustainable energy, and that is, you know, in developing countries, you know, the example of the cell phone that Al Gore gives in the film is that when cell phones were invented, developing countries actually took them on much faster than developed countries because they were able to skip landlines. They were able to leapfrog over an incumbent technology that was very labor intensive to get phone wires into people's communities. The same thing is happening with solar. You're seeing solar panels on top of grass huts, on top of schools in the middle of places that don't have electrical infrastructure, and that leads to education in those communities in developing countries, which actually also lowers the birth rate and makes life for women more viable in the workplace. So there is a feedback loop when you start to go down the path of sustainability.
Well, we do have former Vice President Al Gore on the line with us now. And Al Gore, good to have you back with us on Forum. Welcome.
Hey, thank you very much, Michael. Great to hey, Bonnie. Hey, John.
Hey, how are you doing?
It's that Tennessee hey that we're talking about here. That shout out to everybody. Good to have you with us. In the movie, there's a lot of talk about you're moving between hope and despair. You even talk about some of your frustrations and disappointments. And I imagine you must have felt that way after meeting with President Trump. At least the consequences of what did not come out of that meeting. Just wondering, where are you now? You're pretty much on the hope continuum now, so it would seem.
Yeah, very, very definitely. I hasten to add that my hope is based on the assumption that this powerful momentum coming out of the Paris Agreement and fed by the enormous technological progress. And John, I tuned in just in time to hear John giving the example of how solar panels are following the pattern of cell phones. And that's a broader pattern, by the way. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal this morning about how medical technology is actually moving faster in some of these developing countries where cell phones are a more ubiquitous part of life than in the rich countries. So all of those things do give me a lot of optimism and hope. We need to move faster than we are, but the pace is accelerating. We could move faster still if we actually had presidential leadership on this issue instead of an effort to put up roadblocks. But we're going to win this in spite of Donald Trump.
Well, it's good to hear that kind of optimism coming from you. You know, because of your optimism and because of the contribution you've made to the fight where climate change is concerned, I just happened to last week talk to former Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, who said, well, we want to see if we can get started some kind of program to have former Vice President Gore run again for president. and I know you say in the film that you're a recovering politician and haven't had a relapse. And the longer you go, the longer you're unlikely to have a relapse. But that's pretty much the essence of it, is it?
Well, yeah, you've used all my lines, so I'll just refer to your to your answer. And Lynn is a great friend. I enjoyed serving with her. I'm not sure I would classify this recent comment as an act of friendship.
Well, she seems convinced that maybe there's some possibility there. But what do you hope will come out of this sequel? We've heard from the two filmmakers, and you are the center of the film. And like I said, we even get a glimpse of you in what you call your hold-up place in the Ozarks there in Tennessee. What do you hope people will understand more about climate change, particularly those who don't really get it?
Well, one thing, there are a couple of things different in the last decade. One is, of course, the climate-related extreme weather events are unfortunately way more numerous and more destructive, and that's true not only in California but all over the world. And that's waking people up, including people who may not want to use the phrase global warming or climate crisis. They see these changes and they're disturbed by them and know we need to act. The second big change, again, is that we have the solutions now. They were visible on the horizon a decade ago, but you have to kind of rely on the technology experts to reassure you that, yes, they're coming. It's like computer chips and mobile phones. They're coming down in price so quickly, they're just going to take over. And now that's actually happening. And the leadership, while not present in the White House, is present from Jerry Brown here in California and a lot of other governors and mayors and business leaders, including a lot of California businesses. Apple and Google are among those leading the way, going 100% renewable. And the scene in the movie that Bonnie and John captured in Georgetown, Texas, is an example of a widespread growing phenomenon where conservative Republicans who don't necessarily even want to talk about global warming are doing the math and looking at how much money can be saved by shifting to renewables and other technologies that have the side benefit, in their view, of cleaning up the air. And then they start appreciating the fact that the air is cleaner, and they let themselves, say, it's a good thing that we're saving the planet for the next generations as well.
We've been talking to filmmakers Bonnie Cohen and John Schenck about an Inconvenient sequel, a new documentary they've produced with former Vice President Al Gore about the perils of climate change. And former Vice President Gore is on the line with us. What do you think about the defiant efforts, I would characterize them, right here in California by Governor Jerry Brown?
Oh, they're so terrific. I I've known Jerry Brown for decades and have always been a fan, and he really went to the mat with the legislature to get this historic new law passed here in California. And I know there are a few who think it doesn't go far enough, but my goodness, it is a tremendous act of leadership, praised on the editorial page of the New York Times yesterday. And he's terrific, and he's not alone, by the way. He may be the best, but there are others: Jay Inslee in Washington, Andrew Cuomo in New York, and all these mayors. And it really is very exciting. And California has also demonstrated that when you provide leadership on climate policy, it actually helps the economy. Solar jobs are now growing 17 times faster than other jobs in the economy. The single fastest job, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, for the next 10 years is going to be wind turbine technician. And all over the world, we're seeing that the sustainability revolution and renewable energy and efficiency actually represent the brightest potential for creating tens of millions of new jobs and restoring some dynamism for sustainable economic growth.
We've got seconds left here. I have to ask you out of left field. You're hopeful about solutions where global warming and climate change are concerned. I know you gave a speech Tuesday saying we need single player with all the machinations going on by Mitch McConnell. Is there a hope for single player as a solution?
Yeah, I think there is. You know, Medicare for all would be an easy way to do it. And I was happy that Chuck Schumer laid out his vision yesterday and said that the Democrats are now finally open to that solution.
I'm going to have to wrap it up. Thank you so much for joining us, Al Gore.
Thank you.
And thank you, Bonnie Cohen. Thank you, John Chang.
Thanks for having us, Michael.
Appreciate you all being with us on this Hour of Forum. Thank you to our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Hour repeated in the evening, 10 to 11. For all of us at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.